Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Ruben Stern. 2012 marked two important four-year cycles. In the summer, we watched athletes compete in the London Olympics, and then in the fall, we got to choose the winner in the U.S. presidential race. Those same two themes, sports and politics, dominated the news here in Missouri throughout the year. The Missouri Tigers survived the first season in the SEC Conference. Meanwhile, Missouri's Todd Akin dropped the ball in his U.S. Senate bid with some controversial comments about rape and the female anatomy. But across local races, Republicans won supermajorities in both the state House and the state Senate for the first time since the 1800s. Earlier in the year, a summer drought withered crops across the state, and in Columbia, news headlines were dominated by a string of youth violence, changes in public transportation options, and a community backlash against the creation of an enhanced enterprise zone, which a lot of people probably still don't know what that is. Today, we revisit some of these stories, and we look back at other news that made headlines in 2012. We'll also look forward toward some stories likely to command attention in 2013. Joining me are some journalists who have been a little busy this year. First, Scott Swofford is the senior city editor for the Columbia Missourian. He's also an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to the program, Scott Swofford.
Thanks, Ruben. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you back in our studio. Also revisiting our studio, Laura Wegman is the city editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune. Welcome back, Laura Wegman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you as well. On the phone, we also have David Lieb. He's a Jefferson City-based correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome to our show, David Lieb.
Hi, glad to be joining you.
Glad to have you with us as well from Jefferson City. We hope that those of you in our audience will join the conversation as well. What are you going to remember most from the year 2012? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'll start off by going around the table for the biggest local or state story of the year. Scott, we'll start with you. Biggest story of the year.
It's really difficult to know where to start, but I think I would have to rank the drought and the summer heat wave as probably the most important story that unfolded over the course of the year, both in terms of the impact on the state and in terms of the effort that we poured into it, at least at the Missourian newsroom. The drought really, and actually the weird weather, it wasn't just the drought, but the record warmth. This is the warmest year on record for not only Columbia, but the state of Missouri. Really went all the way back to the beginning of the year. January, we had record warmth in February. We had weather conditions in March that were unheard of. I mean, I was even finding mushrooms on March 15th, which is just freakish. You normally don't find those till after tax day. So it was a really freakish weather year. And the drought, as the summer unfolded and the intense heat wave, I think we had a string of nearly an entire month, maybe even more, with temperatures above 95 degrees and most of those over 100 degrees. And the impact of that was across the spectrum. We did stories at the Missourian about the impact on cattle, on crops, on lawn care businesses, on vineyards, on the watersheds, the river systems. It really was a very intense thing. And although, you know, the elections certainly were a big deal, and we can talk more about those, and we will, to me, I think the drought takes the cake as the biggest story of the year.
Right. David, there was a lot of legislative stuff related to that too, right?
There was some action at the state capitol related to the drought. One of the things was not actually legislatively related, but it was something Governor Nixon did, and that was a grant program to help farmers drill new wells. That exceeded expectations many times over. I think he started it out as a program that was $1 million or a few million dollars, and it ballooned to something that was many millions of dollars because of the interest.
And what's going on with that now? I mean, how is that going to impact us as we go into the next year?
Well, the program is wrapped up in the sense that people who have not yet applied cannot apply and get grants under this higher matching rate for drought relief on wells. But the state is still going to be paying for that, and that's one of those things that we will figure out when the new year begins in the legislature. It's possible that we could see that as a supplemental budget request to help pay for that.
Mm-hmm. Laura, anything to add about the drought coverage this year?
I agree that that was a top story. I think that could end up continuing as a story into next year as well, because there have been so many predictions about food prices going up. We may see some lingering aftermath of that, I think, going into next year, even though, as you can see today, we've gotten a little bit of moisture, but I think things are still on the dry side, and this year has been a real anomaly. So right. I think going forward, it'll still continue to have an impact.
And would you peg that as your thought for the biggest story of the year, or is there another story that strikes you as particularly big?
Yeah, in our Tribune kind of ranking of the top stories, the drought was up there toward the top, but what actually topped it was the University of Missouri's first year in the Southeastern Conference. And, you know, that was a big story just from the sports angle, but beyond that, there's a lot of, you know, economic impact, just impact on the university as a both sports and academic institution. There was so much excitement in town. It's maybe easy to forget that now that the football season was a little lackluster. But, you know, if you think back to what it was like this summer and fall before the season even began, there was a lot of excitement out there, a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen. And, you know, I still think it stacks up as definitely a top story of the year.
Mm-hmm. Scott, how did it go covering it at the Missourian?
Mizzou joining the SEC. Yeah. I know not only our sports department, but our news department poured a lot of resources into that. We did a special section on each of the SEC schools that was immensely popular. The sports department put that together. And particularly surrounding the first game, the first home game against Georgia, and then when Alabama came to town, it was all hands on deck in the Missourian newsroom, going out and just finding every angle we could on that. And sports stories routinely ranked among our best read stories of the week. As a government editor, that used to frustrate me quite a bit, but I've come to realize that, okay, sports dominates in some people's minds. But week after week after week, the stories we were doing about Mizzou football and the SEC were the dominant stories, most read by far. No comparison, really. And particularly, again, the first week when Georgia was coming to town, and the sea of red that came with the Georgia fans, people were mesmerized by that coverage, and it seemed like we just couldn't do enough with it. And our outreach team really did a lot with that, too.
So. Right. Yeah, it really has been something, those game weekends, all those people coming in from the other schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really interesting change.
Yeah, I think we're finding that the SEC does things a bit differently. You know, I met people from Georgia who said we essentially take 4 months off work, which must be nice, and get in our RVs and follow the team all across the country for 4 months. So, yeah, there's a different culture that I think Missouri is still adapting to there.
Interesting. Let me remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're looking back at the big events of 2012 and looking forward to 2013. Joining me in the studio are Scott Swofford, the senior city editor at the Columbia Missourian, and Laura Wegman, the city editor at the Columbia Daily Tribune. On the phone, we also have David Lieb, correspondent for the Associated Press. For those of you in our audience, are there other big stories from the year 2012 that you think should be on the list? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of the conversation at that time and watch our video stream by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. David, your turn. Biggest story of the year.
Well, I think it races the Missouri Senate race. And actually, that is the story that came out on top in the AP's annual poll of Missouri newspaper editors and broadcast producers. It just edged out the drought, which is what we've been talking about. And I spent a lot of time covering the Missouri Senate race because I focus on government and politics. And what made this race so unusual, I think, was not that it was particularly close. What made it so unusual was the intense national focus on the race and the extent to which it shaped national politics. The comments that Todd Akin made back in August about women's biological defenses against rape really immediately spread over to national politics, right on up to presidential candidate Mitt Romney and the head of the Republican National Party, and it was unlike anything we've seen recently in Missouri Senate races.
Right, not exactly the kind of thing that a lot of Missourians want to be put on the map for, right?
No, but top stories don't necessarily mean stories you're particularly like or stories that bring you good attention, right? It's just stories that make news.
Right. And did that have an effect on other elections or other races going on in the state?
Well, I think it did, and here's how. I think the Missouri Senate race sort of sucked the air out of the room, so to speak. There was so much attention on the Missouri Senate race that candidates for down-ticket races, even for Missouri governor, didn't get the coverage they might otherwise have. And I know I was in this position a time or two when there were candidates running for governor wanting a story about something, and I would have to turn to them and say, I'm sorry, I just can't cover this today because my time is eaten up with the Senate race today.
Right. And were you surprised that it did that?
I was surprised, and this is sort of a funny story here. I was actually on vacation when that interview aired, when Todd Akin made his remark. I try to take a vacation after the primary election each year, a short one usually, thinking that that's usually the downtime before things heat up again after Labor Day. And when I first heard what he said, I said, oh, well, that's going to be news. And then I was really sort of surprised about how quickly it snowballed from a story that was going to be on the wire that day to one that was drawing attention from around the country. And I cut my vacation short and came back into work that week.
Wow. Scott, what about the local politics here in mid-Missouri? Was that sort of a factor in any of the coverage or any of the races here?
I don't believe it really was. I don't think the Akin comments really trickled down into the local races, but certainly the local politics, and by local I'm talking about state legislative races, and then we had a couple of interesting county commission races. I don't know that the Senate race had a whole lot of impact on that, but certainly in terms of the effort that the Missourian, and I'm sure the Tribune as well, poured into the local election coverage, made it, you know, one of the biggest stories of the year. Just the sheer volume of coverage that was dedicated to the election. We had four or five state House races. We had a very interesting state Senate race. Of course, we try to do what we can to cover the statewide races as well. And then the county races, the ballot issues. In terms of the amount of effort we had to throw at that, it was huge. But, you know, among our readers, the analytics don't show that anything we did regarding the election on a hyper-local level was among the top stories, at least in their opinions. But I think taken as a whole, you would have to think that that would be one of the things that that people were paying most attention to.
Right. In terms of that, you mentioned one of the Senate races that was particularly noteworthy. Talk a little more about that. I think I know which one you're talking about there. Lots of money in that race, right?
Yeah. Mary Still, a state representative from Columbia, was courageous enough to take on Republican Kurt Schaefer, who was the or is the incumbent in the 19th District State Senate. And what's particularly interesting about that is with redistricting, that Senate district shifted from Boone and Randolph counties to Boone and Cooper counties. So while I guess there was a little bit of mystery as to how that was going to play out, I don't think it's a big surprise that Senator Schaefer kept that seat, given that, you know, he's got a powerful position on the Appropriations Committee. He's a member of the majority party. And in terms of Republican politics, he would be certainly on the more moderate end of that spectrum. He was among the people who condemned Representative Akin's comments almost immediately after they came out. So I don't know that there were any big surprises in terms of the results of our local House and Senate races, but they were certainly interesting to cover. Mm-hmm.
A lot of money spent in some of those races. I mean, that one and one of the state House races as well was quite a high dollar amount total, right?
Right.
Yeah. John Wright running in the 47th District poured a lot of his own money into his campaign.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Right. Laura, other election stuff of note on the local level?
Yeah, you know, Scott mentioned those legislative races that some of those were somewhat interesting. He just mentioned John Wright, who won the 47th District seat. There was some consternation in that race, some allegations of a payoff, who would be running in that race in the primary, that sort of thing, which stirred up some interest in that race. One of the probably few surprises locally was that Caleb Rowden won a House seat. He's a novice Republican candidate who beat out a veteran lawmaker, Ken Jacob, for the 44th House District seat, I believe it was. And So that was maybe one of the only surprises locally. I think a lot of people were really, you know, this being a presidential election and then the Senate race being such a hot topic, you know, it's our responsibility at the Tribune and the Missourian to cover these local races, but I think you still see people, by and large, wanting to talk about the Senate race, the presidential race. And when we would go out and survey voters at the polls, that's what they were there for, and that's what they wanted to talk about, which can sometimes be discouraging when you're putting a lot of resources into it, but it's still important. So
Right. And, I mean, the net effect of all of it is quite a historical thing, that the Republicans have supermajorities in both houses. They can override vetoes now.
Right.
How do you think that's going to play out in the coming year?
Well,
yeah, David, you probably are the best suited to answer that.
I would agree.
Well, we'll see if they have to use it. Most things that get passed in the legislature actually get signed by the governor, right? And so the vetoes are pretty few and far between, but they do tend to happen each year. They're going to have to find something that is such a strong party line position that they can't lose even a vote or two. Because although they have a supermajority, which is a two-thirds majority in the House and the Senate, they don't have a vote to spare right now. They have 109 votes when the session starts in the House, and that's how many it takes to override a veto. So on one hand, it's a pretty historic high that they have, and on another, though, it will still be pretty difficult to hold that together to override a veto. It's got to be something where the partisan passions ride pretty high.
Right. Okay, let me remind everyone once again that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're looking back at the big events of 2012, and we're also going to look forward to what might occur in 2013. Joining me in the studio are Scott Swofford, the senior city editor at the Columbia Missourian, and Laura Wegman, the city editor at the Columbia Daily Tribune. On the phone, we also have David Lieb, correspondent for the Associated Press. For those of you in our audience, what stories do you think might have deserved a little more attention than they received this year? We'll talk about that in a minute. Give us a call. Our phone number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We've been talking about the stories that journalists love to talk about, and I want to shift a little bit. What are the stories that people liked reading this year?
Well, whether they liked reading them or not, we have an outreach team at the Missourian that does a tremendous job of tracking readership of our stories on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, and an annual basis. And the results really are somewhat depressing. We just published a story on Sunday about the most read stories of 2012 for the Missourian. And among the top 10, 7 of those involved death. And 6 of those involved the death of teenagers. Some of those were by accidents, university students who died in car crashes. One of our top read stories of the year was the funeral services for Sterling Wyatt, the Iraq War veteran who died earlier this year. Thousands of people turned out for that funeral. I think that was number 5 or number 6 on our list. So although those were very important stories, a journalist probably looking back over the course of the year would tend to gravitate toward more of a big picture type of story, drought, politics, that sort of thing. But when you look at the readers, the things they're reading most are those sorts of things that seem to have a very immediate breaking news kind of impact. Mm-hmm. There was also a bit of frivolity, and I find it somewhat frustrating as an editor that one of the top read stories of the year was a story about a steer running across the MU campus. go figure. I think that was number 9.
It reminds me of when that monkey got on the loose a few years ago, right?
Yeah, or, there was a goat running around in Mexico, Missouri, which is 40 miles away, but it was one of the most read stories of the year for the Columbia Missourian. I have a hard time figuring that out. There's a fine balancing line when we look at these analytics between, okay, are we going to do more stories about the goat in Mexico or the steer running across the MU campus because people are reading them? Or are we going to do more stories about the stuff that we think is really important? So what we try to do at the Missourian is try to find a way to make people want the stuff that we feel like they need. Whether we succeed in that is debatable. And certainly I can understand why these stories about death resonate with people. They're very personal stories. They have dramatic impact, so people gravitate toward those. And then the deaths involved in the shootings of teenagers. Certainly, I can understand why there's a lot of community interest in that.
It's an interesting thing, though, the way that we remember years. I mean, is 2012 the year that the community rallied around the funeral of Sterling White, or is it the year that that cow got loose on campus, right? I mean, it's both, but it's funny the things that we kind of remember and tie to time.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit more about that Sterling Wyatt situation. I mean, that was quite a rallying of the community, right, in the summertime?
Right. I think that was a really big deal. It really resonated with a lot of people. When I looked at our top web hits of the year, that was, I think, number 6 as well. So it was pretty high up there. You know, that barely did not make the cut of our top 10 list in the Tribune. And I think the reason for that is because it was a really big deal at the time. It had a big impact. There was a lot of emotion around it. But unlike some of the other stories that ultimately made the top 10 list, it wasn't kind of a year-long thing the way, say, the drought was, or the EEZ debate, or the elections. So I think maybe that's why the lasting impact is, you know, obviously on people who knew him is lasting. But maybe on the community as a whole, it was more of an emotional moment. But at the time, it was a big deal. Like, you know, it got passed along online everywhere, and that's why it was so popular and had a lot of life on the internet.
Right.
It's an important story. I just think maybe the long-lasting impact wasn't quite there.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I think one of the uplifting things about that is that this was a service that the folks from the Westboro Baptist Church decided that they were going to attend. And I think, although there probably would have been hundreds of people who attended that service anyway, when the news came out that those folks were going to come and do their usual protest, the community responded in a huge way, and I couldn't be more proud of Columbia for doing that.
Yeah. It's interesting. There are a lot of things that Columbia responded to as a community this year. I mean, Sterling Wyatt's funeral was one of them. Shaka Hamoudi's going to prison this year was another one that got a lot of people kind of fired up in the community.
And continues to do so.
Yeah.
Right. And what's going on with that now?
You know, I'm not really well versed on that. I believe that we have groups in town who are continuing to lobby on his behalf, raise money on behalf of his family, and chip in on that. I'm not really well versed on where that might be in terms of legal appeals and that sort of thing.
There's some online petition efforts and that sort of thing, trying to see if people can, you know, go the route of persuading some sort of pardon or something. There's efforts like that still going on.
Mm-hmm. In terms of some of the other, I mean, Scott, you mentioned that there were a lot of stories about young people who died this year that got a lot of readership. What are some of the other things that were contained in those stories?
In those particular stories, I think what we try to do with any death in the community is to go beyond just reporting the accident or whatever the circumstances surrounding that death were. And we do life stories on the people who are victims of those things. And those seem to resonate very well with our readers.
Right.
One of the stories that was among our top 10 was a life story we did on Carolyn Dolan, who's a 19-year-old college student who died in a car crash, I believe. I'm sorry, she might have been the woman who died in St. Louis. But I think it's when we turn those into...
Yeah, Carolyn Dolan was in Kirkwood.
Right. Yeah. She was found in Kirkwood. When we go the next level and make those into very personal stories that allow people to share the emotional impact of those seem to resonate very well with our readers.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple of stories about youth violence in Columbia as well that were a big deal earlier in the year, right, Laura?
Yeah, that's true. This was a really big deal, especially toward the beginning of the year, because there were a couple of teenagers who were murdered, along with another man a little older who was killed, and this all happened within the first 3 months or so of the year. And especially with those two teenagers, I think that really resonated with people because, you know, one of them wasn't even involved with anything. He happened to just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think he was 17 years old. The other kid, about the same age, you know, kind of hit home for a lot of teenagers and their parents. We need to do something about this. And, you know, since then, there have been, the police have undertaken a new initiative to kind of get to these teenagers and young adults and their families and kind of point out this is the sort of thing that can happen if you are not on the right path. And so it's yet to be seen how effective that's going to be. That's just been going on for the past few weeks. But I think, you know, with so many young people getting involved, and then there was the shooting at the Chuck E. Cheese restaurant, which I think really freaked people out, also toward the beginning of the year, just all kind of came together. And it's important, I think, for reporters to put this stuff into perspective. I mean, just because these handful of incidents came close together doesn't mean all of a sudden Columbia is this hotbed of criminal activity. But there is this perception out there that I think was pretty prevalent this year.
Mm-hmm. And one of those teenagers was sort of in the wrong place at the right at the wrong time, right?
Right,
that was
exactly.
DeAndre Orlando, who was in Douglas Park, and he got hit by a stray bullet, essentially, which was a terrible tragedy. And then Brian Rankin was the other gentleman that Laura mentioned. He died back April 7th from a gunshot wound at a party. And I would echo what Laura has to say. As tragic as these things are, I think the statistics would show that violent crime overall is down or at least stable in the city of Columbia. And while these things really cause the community to pay attention as they should, I think we have to be careful about casting Columbia as a place where teenagers are in danger on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And Laura, you mentioned that there have been follow-up efforts in terms of educating the community more and the police getting involved. What went on as a result of that? I mean, what are some of the outcomes of these situations now that we've gone through several months since then?
A couple of things have happened. Like I mentioned, the police have sort of undertaken their own effort, which started fairly recently. But another thing that kind of happened, and I think this developed more over this summer, was this Citizens Against Violence sort of initiative that they started trying to coordinate community activities and get younger people involved in fighting back against violence as sort of a community grassroots effort. And, you know, what the effectiveness is of that is, I don't know, but if it gets people involved more with their neighborhoods and with their community, then I think that's only a good thing to do. And if it keeps a few people out of trouble that might have gotten into trouble otherwise, that's great. So those are a couple of visible things that have happened as a result.
Right. Just to real fast to correct the name of the of one of the shooting victims, I think it's DeAndre Johnson. Yeah, just okay. To make sure our producer has just sent me a note to make sure we correct that real quickly.
Perhaps Orlando is his middle name. I apologize.
I think that's right.
I think that's right. Anyway, one other thing, kind of a big ongoing story that is still in the news is the MamTech, right? It's kind of a leap to get over to that, but I want to try to get to that before we run out of time. That's still going on. The story has not died, right? David, do you know where that stands at this point?
Sure. It stands in Randolph County Circuit Court, and there are criminal charges pending against Bruce Cole, who is the guy in charge of MamTech. He is charged with theft and security fraud. Right now, they're doing all that pretrial stuff that they do about, you know, should we have cameras in the courtroom and, you know, various different pre-trial motions. He also has some federal, I guess it's more of a civil complaint from the Securities and Exchange Commission pending against him. That is not in Moberly, so he has sort of a two-track thing going on, but he is, the main thing is going on in Moberly right up the road from us.
Right, and what are we likely to see happen over the next year related to that?
I don't know if there's going to be too much that happens. I'm not sure at this point if he's actually going to go to trial in 2013. You know, sometimes these things get drug out and trials get delayed, so I wouldn't be surprised if it gets pushed back and it doesn't happen in 2013.
Okay. Let me remind everyone again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're looking back at the big events of 2012 and looking forward to 2013. Joining me in the studio are Scott Swofford, Senior City Editor at the Columbia Missourian, and Laura Wegman, the City Editor at the Columbia Daily Tribune. On the phone, we also have David Lieb, a correspondent for the Associated Press. We'll be back after a short break. We hope you'll stick around, and you can join our conversation by giving us a call. Our number, 573-882-8925. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're recapping the big events of 2012 and looking forward to 2013. Joining me in the studio are Scott Swofford, Senior City Editor at the Columbia Missourian, and Laura Wegman, the City Editor at the Columbia Daily Tribune. We also have on the phone David Lieb, a correspondent for the Associated Press. He's based in Jefferson City. For those of you in our audience, what do you think or hope might end up in the headlines in 2013? We're going to talk about that in a bit, so give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Continuing to wrap up, we've talked a lot about stories that got traction. We've talked about politics. We've talked about sports. We probably ought to talk a little bit about what's going on in Columbia in terms of some of the initiatives and things that we've seen change in town. One of the biggest things over the course of the year has been this ongoing story of the EEZ, which continues to baffle probably a fair number of the people in the community, aside from those who have risen up to work against it, and those who initiated the idea in the first place and thought it was a pretty good idea to start with. Scott, help us understand this landscape a little bit.
Well, it's interesting that acronyms tend to get Colombians riled up more than anything. For those who aren't familiar, EEZs are Enhanced Enterprise Zones, which it's a state program through which companies who develop or expand within that particular zone become eligible for state tax breaks, state tax credits, and local property tax abatements. The trick with this, though, is that it requires that the community that wants to establish one or more of these zones has to identify a particular area as being blighted. And that word blight was really a lightning rod for this entire debate. Opponents of this initiative were afraid that a blight designation that included their neighborhood would harm property values and would open the door for the city to abuse its power of eminent domain to acquire property and then turn it over to other folks for private redevelopment, all in the name of the so-called public good. This was one of the more difficult things that we faced on the local government beat at the Missourian all year, not only in terms of simply trying to explain it to people, but also in terms of trying to shed light and bring some facts to the debate. The opponents and supporters of this primarily were the folks over at Regional Economic Development Incorporated, who thought this was a very important strategy for bringing back some of the manufacturing jobs that we've lost over the years. But what we saw at the Missourian was that the two sides seemed to be talking right past each other, one citing the benefits, the other citing the potential consequences. And so we tried really hard at the Missourian, and we continue to try at the Missourian, to bring some facts into the debate by looking at how EEZs have played out in other communities, what sorts of oversight the state has provided for this program, which, you know, we've really found that the oversight is not very good according to audit reports and other statistics. Again, I think the community activism that comes from the citizens of Columbia is really quite impressive. When they get behind something or when they line up against something, they are relentless about making their voices heard. And so EEZs, essentially, at least for the time being, are dead in Columbia. The council is going to be looking at an ordinance that would repeal the creation of the Enhanced Enterprise Zone Advisory Board, which is an essential cog in the mechanism that leads to establishing these zones. So, you know, much like the reapportionment debate from a year ago, the citizens spoke on this one loud and clear, and the city council apparently is listening.
Right. Laura, your thoughts on the EEZ story played out over the year?
You know, I find the what appears to be the end outcome of this whole thing dying to be kind of surprising. I think if you had asked me when it first started, I probably would have said, yes, this will eventually go through and we will have an EEZ in Columbia and or Boone County. But like, I think Scott made a really good point about the two sides sort of talking past each other, maybe at some points not really listening to each other, and especially the opponents just being very vocal about it, not giving up. And I mean, there were so many public discussions where, you know, we're hammering home the same points about what this means, what could happen, why wouldn't this mean that my property could be seized, you know, through eminent domain. It was just, it was impressive the way that the opposition lingered to the point where it finally won out. It was just, I think they had a really dogged fight, and, you know, if they had given up 6 months ago, it would have been a completely different outcome. But it was an impressive show for sure.
Right. I really think part of this is there seems to be a large degree of skepticism about tax credits in general. And I don't know if David might have a comment about this. And it kind of harkens back to MAMTEC. A lot of people are looking at the MAMTEC thing as evidence that the state tax credit programs don't have enough oversight and that we're overusing. I mean, we have umpteen 9,000 different kind of tax credit programs, and I think a lot of people are sort of tired of it.
Yeah, absolutely. There are about 50 or 60 different tax credit programs in the state of Missouri, and in the 2012 fiscal year, I believe they totaled about $620, $630 million worth of redeemed tax credits. Those are just the ones that were cashed in that year. There's hundreds of millions more that are still pending that can be cashed in this year or the year after or the year after, because sometimes these tax credits carry forward. And this is going to be one of the things that's going to be on the top of the agenda at the Missouri legislature this year. That is, do we want to rein in some tax credits? And do we want to create even more new ones? This was the topic of a special session in 2011 when the MAMTEC disaster hit, and it was one of the reasons why that special session legislation didn't pass. They're going to come back to it this year, and there may be more of a consensus to try to rein in some of these tax credits, but in doing so, they will probably also create some new ones.
So they'll eliminate some of the problem and just extend it in a new direction.
That's right. So one of the areas that there are some who want to create a new tax credit for is what they call data storage centers. And really what that is sort of like a big computer center or something that Google might run or Facebook, where you have a whole bunch of computers in a big warehouse type building. They think there's money to be had there, right? So that's one of the areas where there's an interest in creating some new tax credits. Columbia has been one of the cities mentioned as a potential site for something like that. But to have money available to create that sort of tax credit, the state will probably have to pare back the amount of money it awards annually for tax credits to refurbish old buildings or to build low-income housing.
And how likely is that to actually occur in the next legislative session, that they would make some of those choices and actually get those things passed?
I'd say the chances are better than ever for two main reasons. One, it is still a goal of Governor Nixon, so he's on board with this. Mm-hmm. And two, some of the senators who had been holding up this are no longer going to be there when the new session begins in January. So you've removed an impediment to passage that had helped confound the situation in past years.
Right. I mean, along with that, are there other types of economic development things that we're likely to see at the state level? This has been an ongoing conversation about creating jobs and getting the economy back on track.
Right. And the debate is likely to continue about whether targeted tax breaks or widespread tax breaks are better. There is a move among some of the majority party Republicans to push for some sort of income tax cut in the 2013 session. Now, that could be lowering the rate on individual income taxes, or it could be lowering or exempting taxes for businesses, not just for particular targeted industries, but businesses across the board. That's going to be discussed, and part of the reason that is going to be discussed is because of what Kansas has done. They've cut a lot of taxes recently, and there's a lot of pressure coming from the Kansas City area and the western side of the state to try to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak.
Right. What about the economic development efforts in Columbia? I mean, the EEZ thing was about trying to get more, like you said, Scott, manufacturing into Columbia and to boost the Columbia economy. We've been pretty lucky, generally, given the emphasis on education and healthcare in our area, fairly stable housing market, all those things. What's been going on this year that's noteworthy related to all of that?
Well, I think the argument that Columbia is recession-proof as a result of the healthcare and university and insurance industries probably is a little bit exaggerated. We've certainly felt the impacts of the recession here in Columbia. The manufacturing jobs, I think, would just be one example of that. In terms of where we, you know, the EEZ thing, I think, other than the airport, you know, and we can talk about that, seems to have sort of stolen the show in terms of economic development efforts in Colombia. And the folks who were really opposed to EEZs have been pressing city officials and the city council and the people at Ready to try to come up with a different, more all-encompassing, inclusive strategy for how we can promote economic development. Exactly what that's going to look like, I don't know, but that seems to be where they're wanting the city to go, is to kind of take a step back and look at what's a more all-encompassing approach that we can take to try to do this.
Right. Laura, anything to add about economic development here in Colombia?
One thing that was a little more under the radar this year than the EEZs is another acronym, TIF, Tax Increment Financing. That was not as big of a deal this year, but there was some movement in terms of, for a while, being discussed, should a large section of downtown or the First Ward be given TIF status?
And just to remind our listeners about that, that's where they're given tax breaks as credit toward development, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's basically meant to stir up development that otherwise would not occur because you're giving this developer a financial incentive. So, for instance, there's been a couple of TIF projects downtown, like the Tiger Hotel. Talk of starting a wider TIF district in downtown or maybe along the business loop, those efforts have sort of hit a lull for right now, and especially amid the EEZ thing, which took a lot of the attention. But I expect that discussion could come back up again in the future as another economic development incentive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say particularly for the business loop and parts of the First Ward that don't include downtown, I think the city is still very interested in doing that, but perhaps they feel a bit stung by the opposition they got to the EEZ. Yeah, TIFs, that's another acronym that's going to stir up a pretty big debate if they come back with that.
Interesting. Okay, Scott, you mentioned the airport as an economic development vehicle. Let's go ahead and go there.
Sure.
The airport has been a big story this year. The mayor has been a big proponent of developing service and adding in, trying to get more flights there. He's been on the program talking about it. He succeeded this year in getting flights to Dallas and Chicago. This has been the holy grail for Colombia's airport for years, right?
Absolutely, but it came at a cost because the Delta Airlines flights to Atlanta are going to be out the window just in another month or two here. And then we've got the flights that Frontier is providing to Orlando, Florida. So, yeah, the airport has been a huge ongoing story throughout this year and really going back a few years. But this, I think, was sort of a watershed year in terms of actually seeing some progress in finding some airlines willing to fly to some of these major hubs. I think the city is continuing to work on that. The other thing that's being debated regarding the airport is what we need to do with the terminal building. There's a consultant who has told the city that they need to spend about $17 million to fix that place up. And given the increased capacity for passengers that's been required by the addition of the flights, first to Atlanta and then Orlando and now Chicago and Dallas, they've had to add some double-wide trailers out there just to accommodate the increasing numbers of passengers. And I don't know if anybody would argue that that's a good first impression to make with people.
Well, let me ask this question that a lot of people who don't travel might ask. Why, if somebody doesn't go in and out of the airport on a regular basis, would they care whether the airport has service to these places? Why does that affect, I venture to guess, a lot of people in Colombia who don't go anywhere on a plane?
Well, the thing is, and this is what the city would argue and the mayor, I believe, is that it's, you know, a question of driving Colombia's economic development. You know, will companies be as willing to locate here if they realize we don't have good air service and that they're going to have to fly people in and out of St. Louis or Kansas City to do business here? And, you know, I think they feel strongly like we're going to be a bigger draw with stronger air service. And it's also a big plus for the University of Missouri to have that strong air service. And they've been a proponent of trying to get better service and have, I think, joined that revenue guarantee effort that drew American Airlines here. That was a success. And, you know, I think if they're successful in these efforts, then maybe those people who have never used the airport haven't ever cared to use it might give it a second look, because as more options become available, it becomes more affordable to the average person. I'm taking my first flight out of there next week, and I never would have considered it a couple years ago because it just wasn't as viable. I think there's probably a lot of people that would find themselves in that situation.
Right. And what about the idea of it being a regional thing? I mean, we talk about the airport being Columbia Airport, but there are a lot of people in Jefferson City who travel as well.
Right. I mean, and they've been a part of this whole effort. Jefferson City and Cole County have pledged some money toward the effort that got American here. And, you know, you might someday see some rebranding of the airport as more of a regional service than having Columbia in the name. And I think that would speak to that goal.
Mm-hmm. The airport, one piece of the transportation puzzle, another piece of transportation we've been talking or hearing about all year is the bus service in Columbia, right?
Yeah.
Laura, you're nodding with a bit of an eye roll there.
It's been good. It seems like it's been going on for a very long time, yeah.
So what's going on with that? Where's the status of all those conversations?
Okay, so the City of Columbia said, we would really like to improve our bus service, and we think that students, especially at the University of Missouri, are a huge piece of that puzzle. They first started this out, you know, maybe a year ago, I would say, looking at could students pay an additional fee that would help subsidize the service and help us improve our routes and our service. The answer to that kind of came out to be a no. So then they started looking at other ways to improve it. There was a task force that kind of died out, this sort of thing. In the fall, they started a new downtown slash campus route called the FastCat. Hasn't seen a lot of success so far, but it's just been operating for one semester. So I think what they're trying to do right now is say, how can we make this FastCat thing appeal more to students? They're looking at ways to, you know, potentially even partner up with, say, Columbia Public Schools to get some public school younger students riding city buses, looking at a partnership with Stevens College, selling more semester-long passes to students overall. So they're tackling this from a bunch of different angles. And so far it doesn't really seem like things are sticking, but, you know, there's a lot of movement in the works on that. So I think that's going to continue to be a big thing in the next year or two.
Okay. Again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're recapping the big events of 2012 and looking forward to some stories that we might hear about in 2013. Joining me in the studio are Scott Swofford, the senior city editor at the Columbia Missourian, and Laura Wegman, the city editor at the Columbia Daily Tribune. On the phone, we also have David Lieb, a correspondent for the Associated Press. For those of you in our audience, if you have anything to add to our conversation, now would be a great time. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. We'd love to hear what you think were some big stories that we haven't talked about yet. So give us a call. Again, 882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Continuing on in Columbia, you know, we started off the year in a kind of, a lot of people were panicked at the governor's proposal to cut the budget for higher education. David, you mentioned potential income tax cuts in the state of Missouri that might come down the rails. How would that affect what's going on? I mean, they sort of staved off a cut to the university for this budget year. Are we likely to see proposals to cut the university budget again?
I don't think there will be a proposal to cut the university budget in 2013. In fact, what I have heard is that it is more likely the governor will be recommending budget increases, although they may be small ones. And I think his preference is to have budget increases tied to some sort of performance-based measures. These are measures that have been developed recently that this may not be the exact one that gets used, but let's say the University of Missouri does a good job of retaining people from the freshman to the sophomore year. Well, then they would be entitled to receive a certain amount of increase if they meet those goals.
Right. Scott, how do you think that's likely to go over?
Well, I think that would be an interesting approach. I'm probably speaking more as a citizen than an editor here, but it sure would be nice to see the legislature and the governor get off the dime and find a way to support higher education better. You know, there was one of the big ballot issues that was that we voted on in November was Amendment 3, Proposition B, which would have increased the tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products to fund higher education, public education, and that went down in flames. It's no surprise that it did. It always, those sorts of things always have. But it's sort of like transportation, you know, Interstate 70 and other highway deals. You just got to wonder as a journalist and as a citizen, when on earth are they going to find a way to get off the dime on these kinds of things? And perhaps this performance-based funding is a way to go. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. I should mention another item that's likely to affect the university this year.
Yeah, please.
There is a proposal for bonding that is sponsored by Chris Kelly, one of your local representatives.
Mm-hmm.
Has the support of some Republicans in leadership as well this year. It would authorize close to $1 billion worth of bonds. I think it's a little less than that, of which a good chunk would go to universities and colleges. Some would also get directed to state buildings. So there seems to be more interest for that this year than there has been in years past. Might have a chance.
That would be primarily for capital projects, right, David?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about the ongoing operations there, but for capital projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, while we're talking about the university, we'd be remiss not to bring up the University Press this year, right? That was another big story that left us where we started, pretty much. Yeah?
Right, back to the beginning.
So explain that for people who weren't following that this year.
Sure. So, you know, this was University of Missouri President Tim Wolf's first year on the job. And he fairly early on in his tenure, I believe in May, announced that the University Press, as a cost-cutting measure, would basically be phased out. It would change the way it was structured. And then there was a lot of backlash. They talked about different models for what a university press would look like in the future, but essentially it would not include any of the current employees, this sort of thing. So there was a lot of backlash, not only here but from around the country, and they eventually ended up pretty much completely reversing the decision when a lot of authors said, hey, if you do this, we want the rights to our books back, and you're going to lose all this money from your backlist. So it no longer really made financial sense, I don't think, and they pretty much ended up back with the same editor. It's moved now to the MU campus instead of being under the system umbrella, but that was the only really major change that resulted from that.
Mm-hmm.
Just stirred up a lot of furor over the whole concept of, is this an important thing for our university to have, and would it be worth the relatively small cost savings to get rid of it?
Right. An interesting way to start off as the new president of the university,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
I think he wishes he had that one to do over. And essentially, he did do it over.
Right. So. And do you anticipate us seeing anything interesting coming out of the president's office in the next year?
Well, not being a higher education editor, if it doesn't have to do with local government, I'm not much of an expert. I don't see any great big major initiatives coming out except for lobbying for more money. Maybe mm-hmm. Laura knows better about what we might expect from the president.
Yeah, he's talked recently about, and this was touched on a little bit, it's sort of along the same lines of this performance funding for higher education, where each University of Missouri campus should try to specialize in certain areas, and then they would be allocated a certain amount of funding based on how well they met that goal. That's something that they're looking at under Tim Wolf's new strategic plans. So that's something that'll be in development over the next year.
Okay. One other thing that we should touch on before we run out of time is downtown Columbia, right? This is, some might say, the year where downtown suddenly changed.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of been in the works for a couple of years. We've seen an influx of student apartments. The Odell brothers, through Trittenbach Development, have been developing apartments there in the 10th and Locust Street area for the past couple of years. Their newest complex went up there this year, and then the complex at College and Walnut Streets is now open. I'm not sure if they have all those apartments filled, but the biggest breaking news story of the year had to be the fire that took those things down back in May when they were about halfway through with the construction. $7 million worth of damage. I believe that's the most costly fire in the history of the city of Columbia. And it's really quite remarkable how quickly they were able to get that construction back on track. I think they had 40% of those apartments ready to go by August. But the proliferation of student apartments downtown has, there's been a lot of debate up until now about how that's affecting downtown, particularly on the northern edge where the College and Walnut apartments are going up, what sort of impact that's going to have on the North Central Columbia neighborhood, not only in terms of traffic, but overall character of the neighborhood and that sort of thing. And then this recent proposal to knock down the Niedermeyer building at 10th and Cherry and to replace it with a student apartment complex perhaps as tall as 15 stories has caused people to push the panic button. Where are we going with this? And we're looking at a very real possibility of a moratorium on this type of development downtown until the citizenry can reach some sort of consensus about what we want to happen downtown.
And when you say a moratorium on this kind of development, what do you mean this kind of development?
Well, the concern about C2 zoning is what governs zoning downtown. And it's a fairly open type of zone that comes with no landscaping requirements, no height requirements, no architectural requirements. And so these student apartments have been allowed to develop in within that C2 zone. And so there's a concern that maybe the city needs to get a grip on what this development is going to look like, or to even determine just when do we reach our breaking point in terms of the number of student residents we bring downtown. For a long time, the community has been saying more people downtown will make downtown more vibrant, more vital, more successful. But I don't know that anybody anticipated that we would have 2,000 or 3,000 students living downtown. So I think they're trying to kind of take a step back and see what's this going to look like if we allow it to continue.
Right. And how did that happen, that it went from having almost nobody living downtown to really in the course of, what, a little more than a year maybe, suddenly there are hundreds of apartments downtown? How did that happen so quickly?
I think it's part of just the overall boom in student housing that's been going on for the past few years all around the city, but the downtown is the latest development with this ongoing trend, which is, I mean, around the country, but particularly here, the university has been growing very quickly. They haven't really expanded residence halls, especially at the rate that these apartment complexes are going up, so they're trying to fill in this gap that apparently does still exist in terms of the need for student housing, and this is just the latest area where, why, yes, it's very convenient for students to live downtown, but now other residents are left with questions of where do all these people park and that sort of thing.
Right. And where do you see this going, Laura?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the moratorium. I don't necessarily think it's going to stop, but I think there's going to have to be more attention paid to the infrastructure that goes into it, especially with parking and that sort of thing, especially where you're around neighborhoods like the North Village.
Right. Okay, we have just a little bit of time left, so why don't we go around and do a little predicting for next year and see kind of what you see coming down the pike. David, why don't we start with you, a prediction for 2013 related to the news we're going to hear.
Well, I'm going to talk about the federal health care law a little bit. The governor has made a big deal over expanding Medicaid to bring more adults to be eligible under that. I'll make the prediction that the Republican legislature is not going to do that.
Okay. Scott, your prediction for next year?
I predict that I'm not going to make a specific prediction. I'm going to kind of cop out. David, he's braver than I am. I predict that the city council races, particularly those on the April ballot, are going to be quite contentious.
Okay. Laura, I'm sorry. That's the bell. We ran out of time here. I apologize for that. But that's all the time that we're going to have for today's intersection. I'd like to thank our guests, Scott Swofford, Senior City Editor at the Columbia Missourian, Laura Wegman, City Editor at the Columbia Daily Tribune, and David Lieb, a correspondent for the Associated Press based in Jefferson City. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. We'll